From the early 50s until now, no one does it better than the Platter.
Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender. Heavenly shades of night are falling. It's twilight time.
Only you can make all this world seem right. Only you can make the darkness bright.
My old flame, I can't even think of his name.
My friend is a rapture in blue. With the world far away and your lips close to mine.
Oh, when your heart's on fire, you must be alive. Smoke gets in your eyes.
Hello and welcome to our special tribute to the Platters, brought to you in part by Fate Magazine. We are broadcasting from Las Vegas and the office of Gene Bennett. Gene was there when the Platters started back in 1953. Tony Williams, David Lynch, Alex Hodge, and Herb Reed were the original Platters, signed by manager Buck Ram. Gene worked for Buck Ram. Started off, really, as a volunteer, ended up being a partner in Personality Productions, and was very instrumental over the years, and still is, when it comes to booking the Platters. You know, the interesting thing, Buck Ram originally met the Platters where they were working as parking lot attendants in Hollywood. You and I have a connection, too, really, not connected with the Platters at all.
Aren't you like me, an Okie?
Weren't you born in Oklahoma? I'm from Muskogee, Oklahoma.
Well, I grew up not very far from there. I was born in Barnstall.
Yeah.
And then I went to Webb City for my grandmother's house. And
up in Missouri.
In Missouri.
Near Joplin, as a matter of fact.
Right. It was between Joplin and Carthage, a little town called Carterville.
Carterville. I don't think I've ever been there, but...
Well, we had a notorious speed cop one time that was always... He'd sit on the outskirts of getting the people coming from Carthage to go to Joplin, and he'd bring them into the Justice of the Peace, and they just made tons of money there.
Yeah, probably supported the whole town.
Yeah. But I think...
Now, you were a singer originally yourself, or at least you wanted to
that
be.
That was my main ambition. Uh-huh. Yes, it was. And I had gone through high school and all the contests and won a lot of contests in singing, and I'd made up my mind that I really wanted to be a singer.
So what'd you do, just pack up and go to Hollywood?
No, no, I took a long detour around.
Okay.
Because it so happened that when I was just in... The year I graduated was the year the war started, 1941, 42, and so I got involved with the war.
We now know how old you are, and you're still working, and Personality Productions doing great.
Every day.
And you have, you do lots of things, but the Platters is what I usually know you
about.
Well,
Platters were our specialty, but I handled many acts with Buck Ram. Over the years, we have had 15, 20, 30 acts going through here at least.
And we're going to get into how you met Buck Ram and the Platters, the history of the Platters, and everything about that as we go along. But first of all, the war came along, and you volunteered to work with USO, Red Cross,
no,
or something?
No, I was going to business college. I had completed high school in 1941. I had 1 year of shorthand, and I knew to be a good secretary, I had to have one more year or something of shorthand. So I enlisted at the Joyner School of Business College because I couldn't go up to Springfield. They offered me a scholarship on the basis of my singing, but my dad wouldn't let me go 60 miles away from home all by myself.
That's not all that far.
I know, but in those days, you know, he just would not hear of it. So I said, well... I've got to have this shorthand improved. And, you know, the reason I took up shorthand in the first place was because I could take my lyrics off of the radio on all the songs I wanted to learn. So everything tied with singing from day one.
A little incentive. In fact, your whole career was tied with singing, and we'll get into that a little bit.
Even though I never quite made it, I've had a ball.
So, during the war, where were you?
I was in Carthage, Missouri, going to school, and I took my lunch money. They were building a huge camp just 60, no, 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 it was 30 miles away.
You're talking about an Army
camp.
At Camp
Powder, Missouri. Big Army camp, yeah, the Signal Corps. Big Signal Corps.
Okay, I took my basic training at Fort Leonard Wood on up.
Yeah, that was farther on.
Right.
Yeah,
between Springfield and Rolla.
Right.
So you didn't leave home. Your dad got his way.
Yeah, well, he got his way as far as the college was concerned. But I played hooky from school, took the bus and went down to Camp Crowder, which is just 30 miles, and put in my application at two different places. It was a huge army camp, all being in the big old barracks and everything. And came back on the bus, and about a week later, I got an offer to go to one of the jobs.
And so you went to work there, and in fact, you met your husband that way, right?
Well, after I got settled in with the Red Cross, one of my first concerns was to see if I could find places on the base.
Gene, you told me the story before. It's quite romantic, really. You're looking around for a place to sing. You found a job singing at the birthday party for the soldier, and you did. And he liked you so much, he married you, right? Boy, all the way back to World War II. Gene? Let's take a break and play a song by the Platters. I have a reason for playing this song, and I'll tell you why when we get back.
Heavenly shades of night are falling. It's twilight time. Out of the mist your voice is calling. 'Tis twilight time. When purple colored curtains mark the end of day, I'll hear you, my dear, at twilight time. Deepening shadows gather splendor as day is done. Fingers of night will soon surrender the setting sun. I count the moments, darling, till you're here with me. Together, at last, at twilight time. Here, in the afterglow of day, we keep our rendezvous beneath the blue air. In the sweet and same old way, I fall in love again as I did then. Deep in the dark, your kiss will fill me like days of old, lighting the spark of love that fills me with dreams untold. Each day I play for evening just to be with you. Together, at last, at twilight time. In the afterglow of day, we keep our rendezvous beneath the blue air. In the sweet and simple way, I fall in love again as I did then. Deep in the dark, your kiss will thrill me like days of old, lighting the spark of love that fills me with dreams untold. Each day I pray for evening just to be with you. Together, at last, at twilight time.
Together, at last, at twilight time.
On Gene Bennett's stereo in the background, we can hear Twilight Time, which incidentally was written by Buck Ram. He was a co-writer. This version in the background we're listening to is a group that Buck found, the Three Sons,
And they had a top 20 song in 1947 called Twilight Time. Hey, we'll be back to talk more about Buck Ram and the Platters, so don't go away.
Marvelous Marv Grand Canyon Tours offers you a unique look at one of the great wonders of the world, the Grand Canyon.
Been at the Grand Canyon area most of my life, so pretty much grew up in the area and know quite a few things that the common tourist doesn't know. And I need to avoid all the people and stuff and try to take them to secluded areas.
A day excursion, personally, conducted by Marvelous Marv.
Yeah, we started about 8 o'clock in the morning. We're done about 4:30. Absolutely. And I have a little photo CD disc for him with 1,000 of my favorite pictures and some video. And
no other tour offers so much, and no other personalized tour offers a better price.
So no, I'm still the same, and I'm the most reasonable price tour of the Grand Canyon now. $85 a person. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Call 928-707-0291 or check him out at MarvelousMarv.com.
That's the theme from the Lawrence Welk TV show. In fact, Gene Bennett, we'll get to that in a little bit. Now, on why we are playing this as a bumper music, welcome back to the show. In fact, you worked for Lawrence Welk, I think. We'll talk about that in a moment. But it was really destined, I guess, that you would go to Hollywood. After all, Lana Turner, wasn't she a cousin or something?
She was my first cousin. And it was through...
So show business was in your blood, I guess.
Oh, I guess so. My mother died when I was born, and so I went to live with my grandmother Turner. And I always heard about my older cousin. She was 2 years older than me. And one night when I was growing up and in high school, we went to the show on Saturday night. We went to the Saturday Night Theater.
Sure.
And I saw my aunt walk down the aisle after we came in and sat down with this beautiful girl. And I thought, I wonder who that is, you know. So I called the next day, and sure enough, it was my cousin Julia Jean, of whom I was named after. And... So I went over to visit with her, and then she went on up to Chicago to visit with her aunt, our aunt up there. And when she came back, my aunt worked for a newspaper. She worked for the Sun in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I think she pulled some strings, too, because when Lana went back to Hollywood, it wasn't too awfully long after that she was discovered.
Well, probably so. Another, as you know, these overnight discoveries aren't overnight.
Yeah, they talked about the soda fountain and all that, you know, but I think my aunt from the Sun Times in Chicago pulled some very big strings and got her before the directors. And her first picture was just a walk-on, and she just was sensational. So.
Well, she was a beautiful woman, no doubt about it, and a pretty good actress.
Yes, she was.
You have to hand that to her.
Yes, she was.
Now, I want to get to how you got to Hollywood. I mean, the war was over. I thought you were still in Missouri.
I was in Joplin, and I worked as a bookkeeper at a job.
You know who was from Joplin, Missouri? He's pretty famous, Bob Cummins.
Yes, he was. Yes. Yeah. And so I auditioned for a part up in Central Park that they were putting on.
Uh-huh.
And I auditioned and I won the
Fantastic.
Lead in that. And that's where I got a chance to prove to my husband that I could sing and dance and act.
And
as a result, he got an invitation to come out to join his cousin in California. And he said, why don't we do that? That'll give you a chance maybe to see what you can do. And that's how we ended up in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Or at MGM, actually.
Now, do you remember any of the people you saw in person as they walked up?
Oh, yes. I saw Gracie Allen come out. I saw Jane Powell, and she was dressed in one of those gorgeous ice cream cone dresses that she wore. And Donald O'Connor.
You know, you mentioned Gracie Allen. George Burns, you just showed me a picture of him at his last performance at Caesars before he passed away. And you and the Platters were invited backstage, I take it.
Yes, they were inviting acts from all over the city to come over for the month that he was there, and in honor of his birthday, and they had a big old permanent cake that they'd wheel out, and everyone came back to wish him happy birthday. And
I understood he actually did a dance on a little soft
he
shoe.
He did. He looked frail. But he was robust with his voice, and then when he'd walk out on stage, the gentleman that walked him out there with kind of holding his arm, he said that the minute that he, just before he opened the curtain for him to step out, said he pulled himself up straight as an arrow and walked out there just with, you know, so robust with every ounce of strength and everything that he had. And then he'd get up there and do a little, he'd sit, they had a nice comfortable chair, he'd sit down a while, he'd get up and he'd do a little dance across the stage and keep these silly, cute stories going the whole time. Everyone just loved him.
Yeah, it's that's one of the things about Las Vegas. It's a lot of entertainment history here.
Yes, there is. And I loved it in Hollywood, too, because I saw many people in Hollywood, Ethel Merman, Jimmy Durante. Jimmy Durante, I had an artist called Bac Yen. She was a Vietnamese girl that we found down in San Diego. A sailor had brought her home, didn't know what to do with her, so Buck and I ended up managing her and took her mother in with her because they were very protective, you know, their daughter. And one time she was, while she was here, she ran into Frank Sinatra, and he invited her to come to the show. And she said, well, yes, all right, that's wonderful, but I'll have to bring my mother and my manager. So that night when Frank Sinatra introduced her to his audience, he said, wouldn't you know my luck? He said, just my luck. She's not only got a, she said, it's not only brought her mother with her, she's got her manager with her, insisted on that. So it was funny.
Yeah, now, you mentioned Buck Ram and the entertainment agency and all that. Oh, that's an interesting story how you met him. You were actually, I guess, out peddling your wares.
I was out. Yeah, they told me while I was going to this school supposedly to help you get started in Hollywood, one of the keyboard men that I was introduced to said, Gene, you got to get out, pound the pavement. You can't sit and wait for it to come. You have to get out there and do it. So I said, okay. So I started out one morning at one end of Hollywood Boulevard and went all the way down, Sunset rather. As I was going down the street, I walked into this Carolina Bronson agency and I said, look, I have been going into every agency here and they all want to know if I can. They don't ask if I can sing. They want to know what I'm going to wear and if I've got arrangements. I said, where do you go to hear somebody to pay? She said, well, there's a man down the hallway. She said, I think he handles some singers. Why don't you go down and talk to him? So I went down, and he was back in the back with had two little rooms. And he was kind of in the back, and I said, hello? And he stuck his head around the corner, and he said, yes. I said, I am here trying to find somebody that will hear me sing. I said, nobody wants to hear me sing, and they want to know what I'm going to wear and if I've got arrangements and all that. He said, well, come on in. He said, let's talk. So I made arrangements to go take my compass back, and I sang for him, and he thought I had a very, very nice voice. And he said, he asked questions about what I could do or what I did and so forth. And I said, well, I'm stenographer and bookkeeper and, you know, office worker mostly. And he said, well, I could sure use somebody. And he said, I'll help you if you help me. I said, well, you got a deal. And that's how it started.
And you guys had an arrangement for life.
That's how it started. It became a lifetime arrangement.
Now, Buck, that must have been 1952, 53, somewhere
like
that.
Yeah, about 1952.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Did he have any acts at that point that became major?
He was working for a few country artists, and he would take them into Gold Star. And there was a girl that he was very interested in. Her name was Mary Rose Bruce. She was a blonde, blue-eyed, good-looking girl, and she wrote very well, and she'd come to him as to look at her work. And he found out she had a terrific voice, so he ended up recording her and getting her sold to RCA Victor. Her name was Mary Rose Bruce, is how she was billed. And then there was a young country singer by the name of Audie Andrews that had a terrific voice, and he got both of them on RCA Victor.
So he had experience with major labels. I believe wasn't the Planters when you guys, was that Mercury, or who'd you have it?
We signed with Mercury on the Platters, mm-hmm. But Buck Ram had I'll Be Home for Christmas and Twilight Time and a number of hits and had also played with the Dorsey Brothers. He played sax.
Yeah, why don't you tell your audience a little bit about Buck Graham, because he was quite a talented fellow.
He was tremendously talented. He had put in this.
He was a writer.
He was a good songwriter, and he played saxophone. He paid his dues by going out on the road with various bands over the years, early years. And he grew up in Chicago. He had two brothers, and his mother wanted to be a lawyer, so he not only studied law and got his shingle, he also said, I'm going to be a musician. And so he started arranging. When he finally went into New York, he got the notice of some bands in New York, in Chicago, and they invited him to come on in. So that's how he ended up in New York. And he started working for a music company that would bring in, that new songs would come in, and he would make arrangements for various bands. And then they would have him take those to the bands and try to talk them into, you know. So he helped sell music that way. And he ended up arranging for many well-known, orchestra leaders. Count Basie, he said he remembered very precisely taking this arrangement to him. And he laid it out on the piano and Basie says, Buck, he said, why don't you just pass out the music to the musicians? And he said, and you run them through it. You run them through the arrangement. So Buck said, okay. And Basie sat there and he put them all through their paces, and Basie, you know, never touched the keyboard. But when Buck said, okay, let's do it again, basically, and Buck said he played every note that was written on there, but he said he knew he didn't read that music. He couldn't read the music.
He did that by ear.
But he did it strictly by ear, and he said it was note for note, practically, the way I wrote it.
You remember the name of that song?
No, I don't remember now.
Yeah,
but that was way in Buck's very early career.
Okay, since you don't remember the song, Gene, I'm going to play my favorite Count Basie tune of all times. His version of April in Paris.
one more time. One more once.
Graham, music arranger for big bands in the late 40s and early 50s. Later, in the 50s, he developed the Platters sound. What a sweet sound it was, too, huh? We will be back with Jean Bennett, who will tell us more about Buck Graham. She worked with him for many, many, many years.
And also about the Platters.
As we continue with our history of the Platters. From Las Vegas, I'm Jerry Pippin. This is brought to you in part by Fate Magazine. Tales of the Strange and the Unknown. Every month in Fate Magazine.
Fate.
Fate Magazine has actually been published continuously since 1948. That makes it the longest-running publication of its kind. From psychics and spiritualists, archaeological hotspots and fringe science, to authoritative UFO and paranormal investigations, Fate articles are factual, informative, and entertaining. Subscribe to Fate Magazine today. Simply go to FateMag.com, FateMag.com, or check it out at your local newsstand. Fate Magazine is a favorite for people looking for answers and for people looking for entertainment.
Fate.
Tales of the Strange and the Unknown. Welcome back to our tribute to the Platters. I'm Jerry Pippin. 1953. That was the year the Platters got together. They soon would make record history. But in 1953, they were only an idea. A group just starting out in Hollywood. 1953 was an interesting year, basically a good year. The dictator of Russia, Joseph Stalin, had died. People in Washington thought the Cold War would thaw. Speaking of war, the Korean War ended in 1953. And entertainment in Hollywood? It was all comedy. Bob Hope, Steve Allen, Milton Berle, Martin and Lewis, all on television every week. Speaking of Martin and Lewis, the rumors already were going in 1953. Would Dean leave Jerry? I mean, after all, he had several top 10 singles that year. And one of those singles, well, it was That's Amore.
In Napoli, where love is king, when boy meets girl, here's what they say.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling-a-ling, and you'll sing Vita Bella. Hearts will play tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a guitarandella. When the stars make you drool, just like a pastifazool, that's amore. When you dance down the street with a cloud at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. excuse me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore.
When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore.
That's amore.
Bells will ring,
ding-a-ling-a-ling,
ding-a-ling-a-ling.
And you'll sing Vita Bella,
Vita Bella, Vita Bella. Hearts will play,
tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a gay tarantella.
Lucky fella.
When the stars make you drool just like pasta fazzo,
that's amore.
That's amore.
When you dance down the street with the cloud at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. Excuse me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore.
Amore, that's amore.
And we're in the Las Vegas office of Gene Bennett. And Gene, talking about those days in L.A. back in 1953... You were already working for Buck Ram. You had just started. And you were showing your skills, I think, as a PR person.
And I started writing the personality plugger. It was born in about 1952
this
or 3.
This is a newsletter.
Yeah, it was a newsletter. Uh-huh. And we had this office we were renting, and he said, you know, one day he said, why don't we go out and take a look at my garage? He said, I think we can make an office out there at the house. That would save on transportation,
sure.
Your transportation and everything. I said, okay. So there's a box. When we walked in, it was a bare garage, and there was a broken box, and there was music smeared on the floor and with legal-looking papers. And I said, Buck, what is this? This looks like your music and legal papers. He said, yeah. He said, that's my old Noble catalog. He said, I wrote songs I wrote when I was back in New York and all, mm-hmm. You know. I said, well, I'm going to take it back to the office. I'll gather it up and file it because it shouldn't be out here on a little scattered hole of the floor. He said, no, I guess you're right. So I took it back, and in doing it, I came across this lead sheet that said, only you.
Wow.
And I read the lyric, and I thought, gosh, that's good. I like that. And I showed it to Buck. I said, what about this song, Buck? That's a nice song. He said, oh, my Lord. He said, I wrote that for Bill Kenny years ago. And he said, I forgot. He said, before I could give it to him, he left the band and went back to Canada. And so it got filed away. I forgot all about it. So I said, well, I think it's a nice song. So I laid it on the piano, and when Tony Williams, we had just met him, and he was starting to rehearse with Buck. It was about his second or third time coming. He picked up that music. He said, what's this, Buck? And Buck said, that is a song I wrote for Bill Kenny years ago and forgot to give it to him before he left. Or, you know, he got away before I could give it to him. Tony said, let's try it. And when he walked out that night, Buck said, that's going to be the first song he records. And sure enough, we hadn't met Mercury or nothing by then. It was really brand new. And Tony, it was through Tony that we met the other three platters,
right.
Because his sister Linda Hayes was Linda Hayes.
Oh, were they weren't really a group at all at that time? Just
well, they were, but they weren't with us. They were just Cornell Gunter was with them.
Oh,
and
really?
He had started it. Cornell started the Platters originally.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And Herbert Reed was, I think, the last one to come in, the bass. He was. They had trouble getting him to rehearse, you know. And so they ran into a girl that was a cousin to Herbert on the street. And they said, God, we are looking for a bass that'll stay with us. You know, we can't count on some of these guys that we've been using. And she said, hey, my cousin just got out of the Army. Said he was singing with that Wings Over Jordan choir. She said, he's got a big voice, bass voice. They said, where is he? You know, so she gave him the address, and they went to see. Alex Hodge and Cornell Gunter went to see and meet Herbert. And he said, oh, he jumped at the chance to come with them. And so then, before we had met, we met Tony through his sister, Linda Hayes. And before Cornell left, and Buck was rehearsing with Tony, and he said, you know, Tony, he said, he wanted to be a single. I mean, mm-hmm. she introduced him as a potential single.
Right.
And he said, Buck said, I think you'd be better off right now with a coming trend, he said, to be with a group. He said, I think we should find, he said, you've got a great voice, and this is a good time for it. But he said, I think you need some voices, and it will give you a chance to get more confidence and everything, too. And Tony said, well, I happen to be kind of singing with some three other guys. He said, for Ralph Bass of King Records.
Mm-hmm.
King Federal,
famous,
Federal
famous,
Records,
famous,
yeah.
Rhythm and Blues.
Yeah, they were kind of hot, but the Platters hadn't done anything yet. And so Buck said, well, he said, if you want to talk to them, have them come over, and we'll consider. I'll sign them. I'll sign you, all of you, if they were agreeable. So they jumped at the chance, and we signed them.
And so there you have it, folks, the inside story on one of the greatest love songs ever recorded, Only You, by the Platters.
Only you.
Bennett of Personality Productions, right there from the beginning with the Platters. Tony Williams, when he agreed to go with the group, the Platters, had they already settled on that name?
They had settled on the name the Platters,
okay.
Yeah, before Tony even got there. Herbert Reed, I don't know, Herb claims he named them, but I think it turned out that it was really kind of a joint affair. They were listening to the radio, and they were trying to figure out what to call themselves.
And back in those days,
the DJ
says, Platters.
Yeah, he said, here's a Platter, new Platter, and everything. And Herb says he spoke up, said, why don't we name them the Platters?
So only you was the first recording?
No, they did some. Buck had done some uptunes,
okay.
And they were featuring David Lynch. Then, mm-hmm. And Cornell left shortly after that, so they were without a lead singer, And but Ralph Bass had the idea of having uptunes. Mm-hmm. And so the several things that Ralph recorded with them was managed enough that they had recorded enough that King went ahead and put out this terrible album, including the day that they tried to do Only You and nothing went right. Zola was sick, Tony was out of kilter, it just didn't come off, it was horrible. And they ended up putting it out to make their 12 tunes. You know, because Buck said, oh, God, he said, he gave up that day. He said, we're just not going to make this today. It's terrible, mm-hmm. You know. We don't. This will never be released. He said, get rid of that. Well, they didn't. They kept it. And then I'll be darned when we got our first album on Mercury, if they didn't come out right side by side and issued a single on Federal of that horrible version. And I could just imagine all those jukebox operators where we were hanging out every Monday, you know, to sell records. Yeah, and they get all of the wrong record taken up and started on their jukebox. People say, well, that's not the Platters. Yeah. It was horrible. But
The Platters and Only You was recorded for Mercury later again. I mean, did you go back in the studio and do it again? I guess.
Oh, well, when Mercury Records... they wanted the Penguins because
they had
Earth Angel,
uh-huh.
And that was the only real hit they had, but they were after, and we were managing them by that time. And Buck said, well, I'll give you the Penguins on one condition. He said, what is that? He said, you have to take the Platters, and I record the Platters. So they agreed.
So it was kind of a throwaway deal for them.
Yeah, it turned out to be a throwaway deal.
Yeah,
and it turned
bigger than the Penguins ever thought about.
Turned out to be beyond their wildest dreams, you know. And I was counting up all the hits the other night and how they forced, I think, 8 or 9 years, they had chart hits, one right after.
Yeah, I know they had a lot of number one songs, Only You, The Great Pretender, that was one of their great songs.
Great Pretender. Only You went up to number 4.
We'll be back to find out the story behind the Platters. This is fun, Gene. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're saluting the group, I guess the super group of the 50s and 60s, really. At least the 50s. The Platters. We'll be back.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
This didn't look like anything I'd ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippin Show.
Jerry Pippin!
Welcome back to the show. We're at the office of Gene Bennett, Personality Productions in Las Vegas. And Gene, we were talking about the Platters and The Great Pretender and Only You, two of the greatest songs, really. Alan Freed, he was instrumental in making those successful, too, I think. In fact, you and Alan Freed have a history.
Alan Freed had just left Cleveland when I made my first rounds, and
this is a song plugger.
Yeah, Alan Freed. Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, you said you made your first rounds.
Yeah,
you were talking radio stations.
We started in when Only You was on the I peddled Only You on the road. My husband and I took a vacation from California and went all the way back through, and we stopped at every town, and we loaded with records, and we'd
go in and put them.
Only You.
And now that was the way they did it back in those
days.
You'd go from town to town and meet the disc jockey, mm-hmm. and you didn't have to deal with a music director or program director. Yeah. If the disc jockey liked it, he could play it.
In Detroit, and the day I decided to drive down Gratiot Boulevard all by myself in our little Plymouth coupe, mm-hmm. with the records.
Right.
I got stopped, and the cop says, "Lady, you went through two red lights. I saw you. I was watching. You went through two red lights. This is on Gratiot." He said, "People don't live to go through many red lights on Gratiot Avenue here in Detroit." He said, "It's very dangerous." He said, "What are you, you know?" And I said, "Well, I said I've never driven in Detroit before, fact, I hadn't been driving too long, but there was. And he said, well, he said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm trying to get around to the stations, and it's so hard to try to, you know, find the stations and drive and everything. He said, you want to take a piece of advice? I said, sure. He said, there's a parking lot right there. He said, you swing over there and you park that car. There's a cab stand right there. And you get the cabbie and you tell him which stations you want. You've got the address. He'll take you around. You'll be back safe and sound in no time. You know, I said, sounds like wonderful advice to me. I knew I didn't dare not take it,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
So, sure enough, that's what I did. And, boy, it was a cold reception in Detroit. The program, the regular promotion man was on vacation, and, you know, and everything. And I hammered and hammered and hammered. But I wasn't very happy with the reception I got. Then I went to Cleveland. And lo and behold, I walked in and I said, I'm Gene Bennett from California, Personality Productions. I have a new record by the Platters called Only You that I want to, and I didn't even get to finish. I said, oh, it's a hit here. I said, really? Really? I said, I just came from Detroit. It's a dud there. So they introduced me, and then I found out that there was a young man that wanted a record job promoting records. And he went to the distributor and he deviled him. He said, please, give me a chance to prove. I know I can go out and promote records. So he says, there's a whole stack. There's about 40 new records just came in. Now he says, you go through that thing, go through that pile, and you pick out one, and I'll give you a supply of records. You take them around. If you get some action,
right.
He said, I'll give you a job. He says, you got a deal. So he sat there and he screened all these records and come up with Only You. And picked it out of 40-some records.
You remember his name?
No, can't now. Can't have it in a long time. That's, you know, I might have it in my record someday if I get to really do the research I need to.
I'm
might
sure
run across.
Probably have it.
But anyway, so my work was all done by the time I hit Cleveland. Man, I got a reception from every disc jockey there. It was fantastic, you know, and it was such a shot in the arm that I needed so desperately at that time. But we were on our way from there. It really hit big in Cleveland.
So Cleveland's where it started, really,
yeah.
As far as the records.
And then John Sipple was a Billboard writer and also worked for Mercury off and on. He kind of switched back and forth. And he was in Seattle, but there was a Seattle disc jockey that Johnny took him to, and he played that, and it's an uh-oh thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, hey, what is that? He was back, and he said, hey, that's a gimmick. That's good.
Yeah,
of course, Buck knew that. He made
right.
Tony do that, you know, because he was after Tony to do something special, and his voice broke. And he said, that's it. Let's practice that. Let's see what we can do. And that was a thing that stuck out. That's the thing that the disc jockey started playing, and it hit in Seattle about the same time that it hit in Cleveland. And from there on, it just spread like wildfire.
Right. Could say, well, it's a hit in Cleveland, Seattle, and all of a sudden it's
yeah,
gone.
And all of a sudden.
Broadcasting is supposed to be an original business, but we all know it isn't. They want to know where it's been done first.
Yeah, that's true. Getting that first one off of the ground is
the toughest part.
Yeah, but it was a fantastic.
Okay, now you got a hit record. The Platters going to have to start making some personal appearances.
Oh, yeah. Well, we were doing that. I was. In Hollywood there, I was on the phone a lot, and I got a call from a Catholic lady that had a record shop, and she was calling on behalf of a Catholic priest downtown in Los Angeles. And she said, Gene, the Platters were making local history there. They were playing at the high schools. I one whole year we did high schools and all that kind of stuff. And she said, would you come down, she said, to Father Slee's church, a Catholic church downtown here. She said, we have a very rough bunch of kids, and he's doing everything he can to get them off of the street and get them to come into the rec room or whatever. And she said, the Platters are so popular here in L.A. now. She said, would you bring them down? I said, sure. So we went down that night, and it was rough, those guys. But they ended up making a television show out of it. I'd love to get a copy of it. I know it's in the library down in L.A. somewhere. And it was the story of Father Slee and how he attracted the young people, the young Catholic kids that were on the streets more than off, you know. How he opened up the rec room and they ended up coming to church, and they had a tragedy where a boy and girl were killed in an accident, and that brought them in even more, mm-hmm. you know. But that night when we sang for them, or they sang for them, they followed us out, and they stood under the street lamp. I'll never forget it. And all those kids sang Over You and sang right along and other songs and stuff with the Platters, you know. And they just had the ball. And later on, they made a movie of that television of Father Slee.
Do you remember the first time the Platters played Vegas?
Oh, yes. Yes, I sure do. We got about 3 days' notice. They had a girl act that was bad, and they fired him. And they called up Buck and wanted to know if he would bring them down. And so we had to rush and make arrangements and get down there. And we got to work. It was over here at the Moulin Rouge.
Which
and they
was
were open.
A fantastic
yeah.
Place.
Yeah.
Black operated place.
It was the only
one in town.
Everybody was welcome.
Yes.
Regardless
and
of color.
And huge, huge crowds late night.
Right, right. Everybody was coming over there.
Uh-huh.
But it was only open about 6 months. And we opened it, and we also closed it.
I didn't realize it was open that short of a period of time. It's such
yeah.
a
they ran out
part
of money.
History.
They ran out of money, and the strip really didn't like, you
well,
know,
of course not.
That
it was
much.
Competition
uh-huh.
at that point.
And so, and it was the only one with open doors. So, but anyway, so we got paid off, and Herbie, they took all the money. They made him pay his share of the menus where they'd been eating. He always paid cash for his. He always ate hot dogs and stuff. They were eating steaks and putting it on the bill. And he had to pay half of the, he had to pay his fifth of the bill, and he never got over it.
And he was eating cheap.
Well, yeah, he was eating cheap.
The rest of these guys were high on the hog, so to speak, as we say back in Missouri and Oklahoma.
And they sort of took and divided it up five ways and gave them, you know, demanded they pay. But it was funny. And so Buck said, you know what? He says, well, while we're all here, he said, I'm going to stop over and see my pal over at the Flamingo, and maybe he will let us audition for him. And that's what he did. He let him go in and let him audition, and in a matter of weeks, we were booked in on their revolving stage.
Yeah, I remember those years
around,
ago.
The revolving right, stage. Right. Yeah.
I've often wondered how the entertainers survived a whole set like that without being so dizzy you couldn't.
And part of the time you'd play into a blank wall because, you know, there was a part.
Round and round and round, right.
Oh, I tell you. But we played there for many weeks. And we had a gal keyboard player. She had a big bottom and she, you know, and she,
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
she stood up to play and
mm-hmm.
and
remember
she wasn't very attractive. Lady D, I think her name was. Yeah, and when the entertainment director said to Buck, he said, "Gee, Buck," he said, "couldn't you have picked out a little more attractive?" He said, "Oh, wait till you hear her play. She's fantastic and everything." So when we came back, he said, "I'll be sure you bring Lady D."
Yeah, right. That's the way it works.
So it worked.
Well, that's interesting. Now, Buck actually never, he's just an arranger and a manager and a writer. And,
well, for many years he played saxophone
but, I mean,
and
he
arranged for
the
Dorsey
Platters.
Brothers and, you know, and he liked to work with singers.
Early on, did you guys feel like the Platters were the hit, the group
we felt
for.
That they would be because Buck recognized that something in Tony's voice
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't developed at that time, but he felt that Tony had something that could be developed.
Now you left Buck Graham for a while and worked for Seymour Heller, didn't you?
No, that was I worked for them both simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
Because Buck couldn't afford to pay me in the beginning, so
so you had to have a job.
So I had to have a job. Or he said, why don't you go over? He said, I think they're looking for some part-time help. And so I went over and introduced myself to Sam and Sam Lutz and Seymour Heller. And I started working afternoons. And then a lot of evenings I worked at the other office, or in the mornings I would drop in over there. And eventually I had a full-time job there. And I helped straighten out their office because they had a gal by the name of Dixie, something. She was a fiery redhead, I had a horrible shade of red hair. And when I walked in to go, when I first started that day, she said, see that drawer down there on the left on my desk? And I said, yeah, the bottom drawer. She said, don't ever open it. If you hear it ringing, don't touch it. And I thought, a drawer that rings? What kind of a thing is that? And she pulled it open. It was a red telephone. So I'd hear it ring from time to time, but I never did, you know, I never could figure out. But one day I walk in and Sam is sitting there, and she is working for, I'm working by then as Seymour's secretary, and we're doing busy things with Liberace, who's starting to really catch on and go across country and arranging fairs and all that kind of stuff. But Sam, he had Dixie, and I go in there, and he's sitting with his head in his hands, and I said, what's the matter? And he said, Dixie's not coming back. What the hell am I going to do, you know? I said, well, and his desk was a total mess, had always been, and never, you know. He said, look at my desk. He said, I'm afraid to let anything go because I never see it again. The files, there was a bank of files in her office, and they were stacked to the ceiling with stuff that was unfiled. I said, why don't you let me file some of this? Oh, no, I'll just leave it. I'll take care of it. So she finally, she was a bookie, evidently. She must have been booking.
That's what the red phone must have been.
That was what the red phone must have been, and she got into trouble. She probably spent some of the money or something, and she was on the lam. And so I helped Sam, and we also had a double entry set of books that we set up because they had was working with single entry. And I thought, man, that's going to have to go someday, that's for sure. And I walked in there one morning, auditors was all over the place, and then they enlisted me to help with that. So I had a busy job the first, through most part of 52 and early 53.
Okay, now,
on the next installment, Jean Bennett will talk about her career with Liberace. And, of course, we'll get back to the Platters. I'm Jerry Pippin.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well, I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day. I'll be seeing you in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.
That was the great Liberace. We can't do the Platters with Gene Bennett without covering all of her musical career, and she worked with all of the greatest ones, including Lawrence Welk, Liberace, and Bob Horn. You don't know who Bob Horn was? Have you ever heard of the American Bandstand with Bob Horn? He was there before Dick Clark. We'll be back. In the next hour, we'll concentrate more on the Platters and their great music. And Gene has some great stories. So stay tuned for the next hour for the story of one of the greatest music groups of the century, the Platters. I'm Jerry Piven. My mom and dad are so proud. I'm on Bandstand.